Now I'd like to introduce our first speaker. They will speak for 20 minutes, and at the end I've been told I can briefly, and then they cross that out and put for 5 minutes, share a little of my experience, strength, and hope. So first I'd like to introduce Linda from Texas.
Hi, everyone. I'm Linda Roberts. I'm an alcoholic. I had to write my name on my hand so I wouldn't forget it. I'm a member in good standing of the Into Action Group. That's in Borger, Texas. If y'all are ever around there, I don't know why you would be, but come see us. Since we're in Texas, my sobriety date is December 31st, 1987, so that was a good year. It's really an honor and a privilege to get to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm really grateful that I was asked to speak here. When everybody I know heard that the topic was breaching the walls of ego, they laughed. I don't know why, because I figured I would be really good at it, so. I spoke at a little bitty conference somewhere, and I said that, and nobody laughed, and I thought, oh, no. Well, for me, I was brought up in an alcoholic family, so I really didn't have a lot of what they call self-esteem. I was one of those alcoholics when I got to AA. I was frightened and insecure, and I just carried that big void around inside of me. And so I really didn't think I had was going to have any problems with ego. And then the first time I'm looking at my defects of character, I have written a list of the 7 deadly sins out of step 4. If I misquote things, y'all, I'm sorry. I'm just so nervous. But I knew I would have a lot on anger because I was either really angry or really happy. That was kind of all I felt. And then I was very surprised at how much I had under pride. When I got through, I had as much stuff written under pride as I had written under, written under anger. And so that was really shocking to me. And then people started telling me about false pride and how I might use that to offset some of those feelings of low self-esteem. It was really, I think, through the steps that I've got any kind of humility that I might have. And it was whenever I read that about humility being something that I wanted rather than something that I needed, is when I really wanted it. But it's been through just working the steps repeatedly, I think. When I did the things I was supposed to do, when you get here and you work the spiritual principles of the program, I tried to be a better mom and a better wife and, a better daughter because I wasn't any of those things. And as I did that, of course, I gained some humility. But it was like today, I think step 6 is still my favorite step. That's probably my favorite line in the 12 and 12 where it talks about this is the step that separates the men from the boys. If we repeatedly try to get rid of these defects, and I have to repeatedly try because I can get one and think I'm letting go of it pretty good, and something will happen, and I will just snatch that defect back, especially if it's one of those that work pretty good for me. I love what it says about it's easy to give up the really hard ones that are glaring and that causes trouble, but it's those other littler ones, especially the ones that work for me, that I really don't want to give up as much. My friend Vernon's here. We just talked at his group, and he said, well, I actually had him laugh, and I'm not a speaker that makes people laugh. And he said, you had everybody laugh, and usually I just hear you objecting. So so that's the kind of person I am. But, I've learned in AA, too, not to do that. I was telling them that I really try to work our concepts into the program as well, and that, whenever someone has a minority opinion, concept 5, I will try to listen to them with an open mind and stuff. And I said, my husband always has the minority opinion. So, but, these are the things that have taught me how to maybe maybe grow a little bit in this program. And, you know, by working the steps and studying the traditions and the concepts, I think that that void inside of me got filled. You know, the only thing that can fill my void was my own relationship with a higher power. There's just nothing else that could work for me. I don't know. Some people might come here and never work the steps and get okay. That's not me. I have to repeatedly work the steps because I think I'm sicker than most. I don't know. I just know that if I start veering off away from the steps and stuff, I start getting sick. I start going back to thinking the way I used to think. And when I'm back into ego, my first thought is about me. You know, it's always I. And whenever I'm not, then I can do more, I think, of what God wants me to do. And I think one of the best things that have helped me try to gain a little bit of humility is the 11th step prayer. I love that prayer. You know, it's always reminding me what I need to be doing, and it's not getting for me. You know, it's giving to other people. And, you know, I just think everybody should understand me. I've thought that all my life. I'm so misunderstood. If you just knew where I was coming from, if you understood, it would be okay. And, you know, that prayer tells me it's not my job to get you to understand me. It's my job to understand you. I don't want to do that, you know, but that's what, when I do that, I'm at peace and I can feel my higher power inside of me. And it's the same with all the other little things, you know, instead of trying to get people to love me, which is something I've always desperately wanted, I try to give love. And when I do that, you know, I find I receive it. And when I'm trying to snatch it up, I don't get it at all. I push people away or I'm not one of those two. I'm too demanding of people. And
I'm not sure.
They gave me music. I'm going to get little angel wings now. It's been 5 minutes, y'all. I thought it'd been close to 20 already. Okay. I'll tell y'all some of the stuff, I guess. You know, usually I go to a little meeting somewhere, which is all I talk at little meetings. I just get up there and talk for an hour, and they want me to shut up. And now I've been 5 minutes. Some of the things I think that have helped me breaching that ego, of course, is a sponsor that's willing to point things out to me. You know, I cannot see things sometimes, really and truly, and I'm really trying hard to work those steps and to try to see what my defects are and to let God remove those from me. And I've always been real. I was a biker when I got here, so I've always been kind of a brash. I can't say the B word from the podium, but that was me. And, you know, if I wanted something, I took it. I wasn't shy. I wasn't in them Al-Anon women. But now I forgot what I was even talking about because I thought, oh, I hope there's not an Al-Anon out there. But whenever I started looking at my defects, I thought, you know, I'm not manipulative at all, because y'all, I know how funny that is, but this is so true. I just didn't think I was, because, you know, if I thought your shirt was ugly, I said, your shirt's ugly. And if I thought your shirt was cute, I said, you should give me that shirt. And so, you know, it just, everything came out of my mouth that I thought. And so then when I had about 10 years of sobriety, oh, I was over a man, so I'm trying to manipulate all this stuff. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm manipulating stuff. And I went to my sponsor, and I said, do you know what? I think I'm a little bit manipulative. And I'm going to say it, because she said, no shit. But I really didn't know that. I really didn't know that until that moment in my sobriety, all that time. And I had been working hard. I really thought that I was. I thought, that's not a defect of mine. That's not something I have to work on. You know, I have to work on not being tacky, and which I'm still trying to work on. And so when she told me that, that's when I got to look at that defect. And I don't know if maybe I couldn't have handled it before that. You know, they say more will be revealed. And the longer I'm sober, the more stuff that comes up for me. I think I probably have every defect I had when I got here. And I can guarantee you I picked some up that I didn't even have when I was drinking. You know, I was a big whiskey drinker, and I didn't waste a lot of time doing other stuff. You know, I know most alcoholic women have long histories with men. I probably do too. But I didn't take a lot of time out from my drinking to go chase guys or anything. I didn't take a lot of time out of my drinking to go travel or to go eat. Or, you know, I just went to the bar and drank and raised hell. And so when I got here, I found out there's all kinds of other crazy sick things that I can do that I kind of missed out on because I was so busy drinking. So I practiced some of those in sobriety, and now it hasn't even been 10 minutes, Harry. So I wish y'all felt as nervous as I did, then I would be more relaxed. So, you know, as I proceed along through the steps each time and I get to go back to step 6, I always find out that there is either a new defect that has popped up or else there's an old one that I probably let go of and then need to go back and turn it over. But I can tell you that by working the steps, it really has been just, well, it's been spiritual because I don't do a lot of the things I used to do. A lot of those defects have basically been removed on a daily basis. Like I say, they can come back, but, you know, I just was. I was a terrible mom, and I was a terrible wife, and I was a terrible daughter. And when I got here and started doing the things and looking at myself instead, you know, my dad was a drunk, and he really was not a good dad. But he did the best he could, which I understood that when I became a mom and I wasn't a good mom. And so instead of looking at my dad and seeing everything that he couldn't be for me, they told me to try to be a good daughter to him. And that's what I tried to do. And, you know, he never got sober. I'm not one of those people with happy stories. Oh, my kids and my dad are sober. None of that's happened for me. But, you know, I had to allow him the dignity to die drunk if that's what he wanted to do. And that's what he wanted to do. And it's the same way with my kids. They just told me to try to be a better mother to them. And, you know, I still, my kids were 4 and 6 when I got sober. And ladies come to AA and they say, I did this and I did that when I was drinking with my kids. And I say, I did all that stuff sober. You know, I was crazy when I got sober. And I was crazy for a lot of years. And my kids grew up in a crazy sober home. And, you know, I ranted and I raved, and my daughter's a little bit like me, my oldest one. She flipped me off one time when my back was to her. And when I turned around and she saw me, she ran. And but then one time she wasn't too far away when she said something, and I pushed her. I pushed her really hard. And, you know, I went out to the meeting and I said, this is what I did today. And, you know, we probably should have been saying, is there a new drunk here? We need to talk about not drinking. But what those people did is they said, you know, you need to not do that kind of behavior anymore. And let's look at something in the literature that tells us why we don't do that kind of stuff. And, you know, I've always been really grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a friend. She's probably not in the room. She was a stripper before she got to AA. So now she's real uppity. Goes, you know. And she is always telling me, you need to not say that. You need to not do that. And but I think in AA is where I need to do and say those things. Y'all need to know who I really am if you're going to help me become who I want to be. And so I go to my meetings and I tell the truth. I always tell the truth. And, you know, sometimes I need help knowing what the truth is. I don't always know which defects I have, or, you know, for a long time, I used to just think I was mad when I was either sad or I was disappointed, or, you know, I had a lot of emotions that I covered up with anger. I didn't know how to be disappointed. I didn't know how to be sad. I wasn't going to be angry because those made me feel vulnerable. But anger really kind of empowered me. So I was real good at that one. And I've had to learn to look at all those things. And put the true name on what it is. And it's only through people like you guys that I've been able to do that. I'm just not one of those people that can go home and read those steps and work them. I'm somebody that needs somebody to guide me through them repeatedly. And, you know, I guide a lot of other girls through the steps, too. But for me, I don't think that helps me as much as when someone's guiding me. Because, really, maybe some people say, I work the steps of so-and-so and I work them again, too. And maybe they do. But I need somebody that's kind of focusing on me, that can tell me where I'm going wrong, what my problems are. You know, the last six step I sent to my sponsor, she sent me back a list. She said, well, you know, where you're fearful, you need to memorize this prayer and say it every time you realize you're fearful. You know, I'm really fearful a lot. And I didn't know that until I had to replace it with a good action. Anybody else want to come up and talk for me? Golly, I thought, oh, I'll get up there in 20 minutes. I don't want her to nudge me down. One of the things that I did for my parents, they're both deceased now. Hi, Sandy. That made me feel better. That's my sponsee back there, my grand sponsee. Was when they got sick, you know, I really got to be there for them. I got to do all the kind of things that the people don't really want to do for old people. They both got very sick. I moved into my mom's house when she got sick. And, you know, we never expected her to die, of course. We kept waiting for my dad to drink himself to death. And then we thought my mom will be free and she'll get to do fun stuff. And then she got sick. Isn't that funny how drunks can really live a long time? But I went over there and I took care of my mom on a daily basis. And I was with her when she passed away. And, you know, my sisters are both nurses. And I'm an ex-drug dealer. And, you know, they said, we just can't come over there. You know, that's my mom. I just can't do it. That's my mom, too. You know, but if it hadn't been for the program, I couldn't have done that either. And I realized that today. It's only because I was in the program that I wasn't over there stealing my dad's whiskey or stealing my mom's hospice stuff. And I realized after that all the things that I'm able to do today is just because of the program. You know, before I would just be thinking about myself and what I needed to do. You know, and I remember a lot of holidays. You know, we didn't go over and see the family. If we did, it was 5 minutes because we were too busy drinking. You know, I was so involved in self. I was thinking about one time on Halloween. We were watching our kids walk. We were driving down we live in a little town. We were driving down the street next to them drinking whiskey while they were going from house to house. We couldn't even stop long enough to take them trick-or-treating. And that's the kind of stuff I did with my kids before I got sober. You know, I really liked being a mom. And I really wanted to be a good mom. I just wasn't because I was drinking. But I tried to do a lot of those things. And today I have grandchildren, and they are, you know, I think that's the closest I think I'm ever going to get to unconditional love is my grandchildren. Man, I love those kids, and I'd probably kill you over them. But my grandkids have not really seen me crazy. And that is the gift of the program, because my kids saw me crazy all the time, you know. They didn't pick up their toy room one time, so I dumped I dumped every toy in the middle of the room and said, light it up, because they didn't put a few things in the right place, you know, and they saw a lot of crazy growing up. But my granddaughters, they always want to go with me, and they've never had to see me act out or anything. And now I'm going to tell the truth. And one time I went to see my brother-in-law, and he was having a bad day, I guess, because he just kept snipping at me and snipping at me and snipping at me. And I kept saying, are you okay? Are you having a bad day? You know, was something wrong? And he would not let up, and I reverted right back to my old self. But before I did, I told my daughter, take Lindley out of the room. My granddaughter left the room. Actually, they went outside, and I just tore into my brother-in-law. And I found out later on, though, she heard me. She heard me in there going crazy. So it's still, but she hadn't, they've never seen me go crazy. But, you know, they're very lucky, and I'm very lucky, you know, that it's the love of God that's given me that ability to love them that much, to be able to put them ahead of myself. You know, I wish I could do that for everybody, but I can't. You know, I used to think I loved my husband unconditionally, but I don't. I mean, really, I start thinking if he starts cheating on me, I'm just going to shoot him. And you know, the people in AA, I love the people in AA too, but every once in a while I get to judging them. And you know, that's my own defect of character. I need to not do that. And I try really hard not to, but I do. But my grandkids, I never judge them. I'm never really angry with them. I never have a problem with them, no matter what they do. My little granddaughter's 8, and she said the MF word singing a song the other day. It was in the song. And I was like, you can't say that, honey. And but I never thought, ooh, or disgusting, or you're bad, or any of that stuff. I just thought, oh, I just love you so much. Don't say them kind of things, even though I say it. But that is truly the way that I feel that God loves me. God loves me like that. You know, and nobody else has ever been able to love me like that, and probably nobody else ever will be able to love me like that. And the more that I practice humility and I get away from my defects of character, the more I can feel that love. You know, when they talk about walking in the sunlight of the Spirit, for me, it has to be in moments of calm and moments of peace. If I'm angry, I don't feel the sunlight of the Spirit. You know, where if I'm all into pride or ego, I do not feel the sunlight of the Spirit. I only feel that when I'm working the spiritual program that I'm supposed to work. On the plane when we got on, there was a guy in a T-shirt, and it said, "What spiritual principle is that?" on his T-shirt. I thought, that's so good. I have a T-shirt that I brought, and it says, "Extreme example of self-will run riot." That's my T-shirt. So, and I can't wait to get out of this dress and put it on. But golly, y'all, now that it's done, I can say I had fun. And I want to thank y'all for your attention and everything.
Thanks, Linda. And our next speaker is Harry from Canada.
Breathe, Harry. Breathe. Hi, everybody. My name's Harry, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date was November the 8th, 1972. Thank you. And I tell the members back home, no, I got 3 more years to be an old-timer. I was talking to my service sponsor before I came here, and also to Rick W., the chairman of the, and they said, don't write it up, just let it flow. So it's not going to be in any semblance of order. I'm just going to let it flow. When I, too, like Linda, when I first saw the topic, said, breaching the walls of ego, I said to my wife, man, that's going to be a hard topic to talk on. She says, no, it ain't. Not for you. And when I look back at my life, she was absolutely right. When I got here, or before, let's start that again. I was very fortunate enough to attend 3 conferences in New York. The first conference was in 2007 in place of our delegate, Adrian G., who had taken sick. And my service sponsor told me before I went to the conference, she said, when you get to the conference, you are going to meet a best friend. And I did. Her name is Debbie J. from California. And we've been in touch with each other by email ever since. And I informed her that I was coming here, and she told me she was coming here. And I thought, I'll never see her in this crowd. But lo and behold, I was walking down the hall here towards the ballroom, and there she was coming down on her scooter. I got excited, she got excited, and I thought she was going to run me over with her scooter. But she hit the post first. But anyway, and I also was very fortunate enough to meet Linda at one of the conferences, Jeff out there, Leon, and a few others that are here that I can't remember names. I remember faces, but I'm bad at names. And it's really, really great to see old friends and to meet new friends. Ego, at the age of 17 years, I joined the Royal Canadian Navy. And I do not blame the Navy for my alcoholism. And I honestly believe today that I was an alcoholic from the first drink I ever had. Through my career, I got married, had five children. Lost that marriage and five children through the disease of alcoholism. And the ego throughout my drinking years was always with me. Being a short, 5 foot, 118 pound sailor who thought he knew it all and went to the dances and loved dancing. In fact, I thought I was the John Travolta of the dance floor in those days. And if I asked you to dance and you rejected me, I hated rejection, then I would say, boy, you're really missing out on something. Now, that's ego. That was my ego. And I had ego even after I sobered up. I had learned at a course that the Navy sent me on in drug and alcohol counseling. I learned from a doctor, female doctor from Toronto, and she had mentioned in her talk that she believed, and most of her colleagues believed, that once a person started drinking alcoholically, they stopped maturing mentally. Okay. I strongly believe in that, because when I looked back on my life, it was absolutely true with me. When I started drinking at the age of 17 years of age, I stopped growing mentally. And when I stopped drinking at the age of 32, I was still mentally the age of 17, because it took me many years of being at the meetings with friends like you and learning and living and maturing. Because when I look back at my life, 32 years of age, I'd say to my wife, well, let's go to this party. And if she didn't want to go, then I remember just being like a little kid, of stamping my feet and getting angry and saying, oh, you don't want to do anything that I want to do and stuff like that. That was immaturity to me. All right, that was also part of my ego again. And I remember in the early years of my sobriety, we didn't have videos in those days. We had the 35 millimeter film. And when I was going to our clinic and they were showing the films of Father Martin, he played a big role in my sobriety. Because I remember all the things that he had talked about in the films that I watched that made sense to me. And here's one of the parts of the things. I'm glad that's not me. Anyways, he had mentioned in one of his films that when he had attended a discussion meeting, he heard the topic, and as the different members went through their explanation of the topic and that, he would be sitting there thinking, they don't know what they're talking about. But when it gets to me, I'll tell them what to talk about. And when I saw that, I looked. It was like looking in a mirror. I said, yeah, I've done that. I remember doing that at a meeting, listening to other people talk and explain things and give their suggestions and stuff like that. I remember thinking that at the time. When it said breaching the walls, I looked that up in a dictionary, and it said breaking down or breaking through. And I looked up the word ego in the dictionary, and in my dictionary it said one's self. So I thought, well, okay, how did I breach the walls of ego at times throughout my life, my sober life? And I can answer that today, and there was four slogans that I learned when I first came through the doors of AA, and I still use very, very much and work them each and every day as best I can. One is easy does it, one day at a time, first things first, and live and let live. Those four slogans to me are most of my program besides the Serenity Prayer and You People. The live and let live, it took me a while to learn about that one. I'd practiced the other three day in and day out. But the live and let live, it took a situation that really made me look at it and start practicing it. And that was, I attended a meeting with my father-in-law, who, by the way, has 50 years sobriety. He's 92 years of age, and he still goes to AA meetings. I'm sorry to say, just before my wife and I came down here on the trip, that we had to put him in a nursing home, but he agreed to go. And there are friends that he has taken to meetings, going down and putting meetings on for him at the center. Anyways, to get back to my live and let live, he had taken me to his group, the Blue Nose Group in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And there was a gentleman that they'd asked Jerry S. to get up and read the 12 steps. And I had met Jerry a year before that when I spoke at the Navy Hospital. And he got up to read the 12 steps, and he started to slur his words in that. So I whispered to my father, and I said, why did they ask Jerry to get up and read the 12 steps? I said, it sounds to me like he's been drinking. He says, no, Harry, he's in the early stages of MS. And I learned a very, very valuable lesson that day. Even though I'm human, I try my very best not to be judgmental on people. And to use that slogan again with the other three, day in and day out, live and let live. And those slogans help me to keep grounded the way I am today and the way I try to be today. God, how long have I been?
You have another 11 minutes.
Oh! I told Linda when we sat down at the table, I said, this is going to be the longest 20 minutes of my life. But anyways, during my sobriety and my relationship with my five children started to grow because I was growing. I started to grow up in the program. I started to mature in the program. And I started to gain back the love and respect from my five children. I had heard at my group one time, one of the other members discussed about his children and how he was going to talk to them when they became teenagers and they started drinking. So what he explained to us that day, I used with my children when they became teenagers and started to drink. And that was, I gathered them together and we talked, and I told them, I'm not going to tell you how to drink, what to drink, where to drink, or anything like that. All I'm going to tell you is to respect alcohol, to watch out for it, because you may turn out like I did. I said, as far as I'm concerned, it is hereditary. I didn't come from an alcoholic family that I know of, because my father, when I was a child, was always in Northern Ontario working in either the gold mines or lumber camps. I knew my mother was not an alcoholic because she worked her butt off to look after five kids. But I told my kids that. But God has his way. There's three of them heading down that road, but of the two oldest, they have a sociable drink once in a while, but they respect it and watch out for it. And they are the best things that have ever happened in my life, because today, when I call them or they call me, because they live in Nova Scotia and I live on Prince Edward Island, they tell me that they're proud of me. And I almost start to cry at that time, because it's been told to me in AA that the longer we're sober, the closer our bladders get to our eyeballs. I'm pretty sure I soaked Debbie's shoulder when I hugged her. And today, when I was a kid, I was brought up by my father at times and saying, you don't cry. You don't cry when you're a kid, you know, when you're a man. I cry at the drop of a hat. So please, don't anybody drop their hat. I don't want to start that. Ego today still plays a part, and I think, in every human person's life. It does mine, because my wife and I'm completely retired now. I served 28 years in the Canadian Navy. I served 11 years in the Corps of Commissionaires, which is a security force for the Department of Veterans Affairs. And after that, I got the best job that I could ever ask for in my whole life. And I was a greeter on the front doors of Walmart. The summer that I retired from the Corps, I took the summer off. My wife said, you better get something during the fall. She was getting tired of me hanging around. So I got that job. And it was just for the Christmas period. But luckily for me, I loved it so much, and I guess they liked me, that they hired me, and I stayed there for 2.5 years. And the kids, well, I'm known back home as Happy Harry. And a little 3-year-old girl gave me that nickname. Her and her mother used to come through the doors, and when she found out she was coming to Walmart, she would always say to her mother, is Happy Harry working? Is Happy Harry working? And she would get excited coming through the doors. Well, her mother wrote up a letter. Tommy, here's the ego again. Here's the ego. She wrote a letter, and it was a big letter, and they read it the next morning in front of all the staff. There's my ego. Easy does it, Harry. And again, the management liked it, and they wanted to, the next time they came in, they took a photograph of us, and they put it in the Walmart magazine, but that name stuck with me, the 2.5 years I was at Walmart. And you know what? The best job I love doing in AA is greeting at the door of my group. And when somebody comes up and wants to take that job over, they have a hard time taking it away from me. There's the ego again. But again, it's been a wonderful life. I was fortunate enough to attend the 2005 convention in Toronto. My wife was not able to go with me. She had hip operations. She's here with me this year. Thank God she's not sitting in the audience, because I can't speak when she's sitting in the audience. It gets me all mixed up. But she's here. I brought her down to have a vacation for her. And we've had that. We're enjoying ourselves. We're down here with friends from my area. And we're all going out to supper tonight. And I'm just rambling on now. But anyways, my name is Harry, spelled H-A-R-I. People say, what is that? I said, it's East Indian. I was named after an East Indian friend of my father's. He was my father's best man at their wedding. He used to always visit us and rhyme off this verse. And I'm going to close with this. And it's called, why worry? I have two things to worry about in this life. Either I'm healthy or I'm sick. If I'm healthy, why worry? If I'm sick, I have two things to worry about. Either I live or I die. If I live, why worry? If I die, I have two things to worry about. Either I go to heaven or I go to hell. If I go to heaven, why worry? If I go to hell, I'll be so busy shaking hands with friends I won't have time to worry. So why worry? Thank you.
Thanks, Harry. Happy Harry. I'm sorry that Jean didn't make it, but this is an incredible privilege. My sister and I sobered up the same day in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have trudged the road to happy destiny together for 23 years. And and it is just an honor to introduce her to speak at this international convention. Welcome, Terry.
Hi, my name's Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is a recovery group in Billings, Montana. My sponsor is Donna H. And because of the power of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, a woman like me has not had to take a drink since January 28, 1987. I got to you guys so exhausted. Just worn out in my pursuit to rest, happiness, and satisfaction, and my insatiable need for more, just more of everything, booze and attention and just everything. And never in that pursuit did I ever find enough of anything. And when I got here to you guys, I was just tired. I had run out of friends and family and money and really the energy to do what I needed to do to get what I needed. And when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was begging for help, and that is not the way I lived my life. I lived my life with an attitude of no, and you can't make me. I'll do it myself. And it just doesn't work. I mean, running my life just doesn't work. And running your life just doesn't work. I think that the first real lesson I got in ego, I relate very much to Linda. Actually, I sponsor women who have such low self-esteem. I mean, they don't feel deserving of a job as a speed bump. And I really, when I was out there drinking and using, I really felt more like you didn't deserve to be in my air, the air that I breathed. I mean, I was loud and abrasive and rowdy, and I liked to fight, and it's like Linda said, it made me feel powerful. I didn't even know how afraid I was until I got to you guys. I didn't know that that was covering so much fear. And so I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. My success was so bad that I got here with this mountain of problems and self-hatred and shame and guilt, and didn't even know what to do with it. And I'm so grateful that when I got here, you said I wasn't going to do anything with that, that I was going to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in that process, God would take care of that mountain of problems and shame and guilt and self-hatred. And so That's how it started working for me. And like I said, my first example is Carol and I, who just introduced me. We were all we had left. I mean, our last days of drinking were that we were both pregnant and we sat at our kitchen table and drank, shamefully drank every night because we couldn't quit. And about a year and a half into our sobriety, I started telling my sponsor how she wasn't doing it right and she needed to move. And he explained to me that I was the one that needed to move, not her, that I was the one with the problem, that if I was the one unhappy in the situation, then I was the one that needed to take some action and move. And what happened is I did move, and when I moved, Carol blossomed. I mean, just blossomed in her recovery. What I found out about me is I keep people down in the darkness and the shadows. You know, that was the first real look I got at myself and my ego. And what I found out is that that my ego kills me and other people, that I can't grow and neither can other people under the power of my ego. When I heard ego described as easing God out, it meant so much to me because there was no room for God where there is ego. And as I started working the steps and meeting me, because that's kind of what happened when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and started working the steps, I quit running from the monster, and I turned around and looked, and the monster was me. And when I did that fourth step and got to the part about the things that I had done, I realized that I didn't drink because of life's conditions, that I had an unusual reaction to life's conditions, and that I wasn't even defined by the things that I had done. That I was a child of God, and all the people on my resentment list. I remember getting to that part where we realize that perhaps they were spiritually sick like me. And before I've ever gotten to, some people never forgive themselves, but I'm always the first one I forgive. And when I got done with my fifth step, and I was crying, and my sponsor was crying, and my sponsor said to me, "Terry, all that stuff, that was the absolute best you could do without God's help." And she said, "Everybody on your resentment list, that was absolutely the best they could do without God's help." And it absolutely altered the way that I looked at human beings as we walk on earth, that we're all doing absolutely the best we can. And I can tell you on many days in my own life, it looks really bad. But when I go to bed at night and I do that nightly review and I see I've done absolutely the best I can, sometimes without God's help, because I've been running the show. And I almost always know now when I'm running the show because it's painful. It hurts me and it hurts other people. Ego is the killer. I mean, resentment is the killer. Resentment even stem for me from ego because I think I know. I think I know something. And somebody's not doing it right, or somebody's not doing it my way. I know that when my ego is out front, then I'm not useful, that God can only use me if I can keep my ego back behind me. And that comes from me for doing the same thing today that I did when I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, trying to stay in fit spiritual condition by using the book and prayer and meditation. I mean, those things have not changed for me in 23 years. And as soon as I think like I don't need to be doing that, it does not take long for the ego to take over for me. I don't believe that 23 years of sobriety can do anything for my my sobriety today. I think all that stuff I did kept me sober the last 23 years. But if I want to stay sober today, I'm going to have to read out of the book, and I'm going to have to get on my knees and pray to a God of my understanding. I'm going to have to meditate, and I'm going to look outside of myself for somebody else that needs help. And I'm going to have to keep that ego behind me, because I'm not it. I'm only part of it, and God can only use me if I'm not led by my ego. And since I came in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous and admitted I was powerless over alcohol, the big job has been to stay that way, to be powerless over alcohol and people, places, and things, and allow people, even the women I sponsor, the dignity of their own experience. That tolerance means allowing people the dignity of their own opinions and mistakes and experiences. And that has not been easy for me from where I come from. But that is truly what it's all about, I think, for me in Alcoholics Anonymous, is just to become a useful human being for God. And the idea that I get to walk the road of recovery with people who invite me into their life, that call me sponsor, and that since the day I walked into the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been placed in a position of responsibility and not authority. That my job is to be an attraction in every sense of the word. That to be to make recovery look fun, because it is. It is. Sometimes I get a little too serious about this stuff because it is a life or death situation, but I walk in joy today. Regardless of what is going on in my life, I get to walk with joy. Linda, I think, was talking about her father. My father was a chronic alcoholic, and as children, we didn't even know that. My mother hid it well, and I'm a Navy brat, so he was gone a lot. And when he came home, he'd just have armloads of puppies or toys. You know, we never knew Dad was a drunk coming home with gifts, you know, asking for forgiveness. He just looked like Santa Claus. And my dad ended up dying in my home under my care of alcoholism. And it was just my job to keep him comfortable. And when he first got sick, he got to a place where he couldn't even hold a drink, and I held it for him. I don't know if that's right or wrong. I'm sure there are a lot of people who would have thought that was horrible. But personally, he wasn't getting sober, and I know what it's like to need a drink. And I held it for him. And when my dad died, I felt a sense of humility I am sure I will never again experience in my life. But what I have is a picture of what I get to aim for. You know, I'm a servant. I got saved, dragged back from the gates of hell just this close. And today I get an opportunity to help drag people back from the gates of hell also. And that is a huge privilege. And it's also a huge responsibility. And I don't know that I have much more to say, except for I'm having the time of my life in recovery. And I hope you are too. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. What an honor. It is just a cool deal to share this with my sister. I know there's a lot of people in the program that their families don't even support them in Alcoholics Anonymous. And let me tell you, our mother loves Alcoholics Anonymous. She sat at my 20th birthday. My mother sat across from a table at an AA meeting and told me that that birthday meant more to her than the one she gave me. And I just can't believe that we have been given that gift and that families have been restored, at least in my experience. So I'm going to share 5 minutes because that's what they told me. And I'm a hairdresser, so I like to run ahead. So it looks like we'll get out of here a little early, but I just want to explain how ego affects me today, because it is still my first response to most every experience that happens to me. I've just learned not to listen to it as much today. I got the letter first. I've been hanging out with a gal who's our delegate, and I wasn't even involved in service in that structure for the first 20 years of my sobriety. I showed up, I sponsored women, I opened, I did those kinds of things, but never GSR and district and all that. Well, she's delegate, and Carol, thank you for this. And so she submitted my name, and I got the letter that I was going to chair a meeting, and I was just thrilled. What an honor to get to be a part of this international convention. And then I talked to a couple more people, and they're sharing at a meeting. Really? So, I only get to chair a meeting, and they share. So, the good news today, because I've worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a sponsor to share those things with. It took me just maybe a day, maybe two, before I got back on track and could feel what a privilege it was to be a part of this international convention. It is true that my ego wants me alone and feeling separate and wants me feeling not good enough. And so it is still today the experience, like Terry talked about, that I need to get up and get on my knees. I need to read. I still read 86 through 88 and try to get the women that I sponsor to read those pages. It is just a guide, a design for living that I still need today. The most important part for me is pause. Pause. Just pause. That'd be good. When agitated and doubtful, because my ego does want all those things for me, and God wants me to be living happy, joyous, and free. And I need the diligence and the discipline of this program to allow me that lifestyle. It just does not come to me naturally. Today, for me, the glass is still half empty, and that is frustrating to me. I want to be the half full kind of gal, but it takes that kind of diligence and work and going to meetings. I still try to convince my sponsees three meetings, minimum three meetings. That's not asking. I still go to 5 to 6 meetings a week at 23 years sober, and I'm still not sure that's quite enough for me. Thank God I didn't get well too fast, seriously, because it's kept me doing the things I need to do in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just thank you for letting me share and be a part of this convention. And again, I want to thank Linda and Happy Harry and Terry for sharing today. Thank you. Enjoy. Enjoy.